Well, you did it. You got to a Friday.
I did.
How about that?
I made it.
And we are here on a Friday, and it's good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you.
Did
as
you?
Well.
I'm sure you stayed up till the final whistle last night.
No.
Oh no.
I did not.
No. I also did not.
Oh, okay. I don't feel so bad.
I couldn't make it. But it was a 3-2 loss to Turkey.
Okay.
Yesterday. It was the final game in the group stages.
But they still advanced, though, right?
They do still advance. And the way this works is if you win your first two games of the three-game set that you'll play in the group stage, so you'll play the three other teams in your group, you win those first two games, you're in.
It's in. You're in. Yeah.
So it was a game that you had to play because it was on the schedule.
Yeah.
That's all it was. But I thought there are some things that you got to be careful about here because everybody's talking about this U.S. team as being like, whoa, hold on, could they? How far can they go? Really? You don't think they can win it the whole? No. I don't think they can win the whole thing.
Okay.
So we just enjoy the ride as it is.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
It's the opposite of what the Pistons went through in the playoffs.
Direct.
Where we had some certain expectations.
We did.
Now, we thought they were going to win an NBA championship, but could they get there? Probably.
Uh-huh.
That was what we were thinking.
Yeah.
Regardless, there are some things that I think this U.S. team should be worried about going into the next stage, which is Wednesday against Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Uh-huh.
And you start getting into these games where you can't lose. There is no other game.
And maybe, you know, yesterday they knew that they were going to advance anyway, so maybe just didn't have the accelerator down. When they play Bosnia-Herzegovina, I think it's different. They're going to be on all cylinders. All cylinders are going to be popping.
Yeah, so no worries here. Good. Everybody's good. We're moving on.
Yep.
But
it's all good.
Just... I'm a little worried, but based on what I saw last night. But again, I don't think they were playing with the urgency that they wanted.
No.
They scored early, and then they got taken over, and then tied it up, and then got the late goal late. So, no harm, no foul here.
Detroit Lions cornerback Terrion Arnold was in court yesterday in Florida following his arrest in violent kidnapping and robbery case tied to an incident back in February. Tampa Bay police say three victims were allegedly beaten, held at gunpoint, pistol whipped during a robbery involving more than $250,000 in stolen property. Investigators allege Arnold coordinated with several co-defendants after reporting the theft, then helped arrange contact with one of the victims and lured him to an apartment he had rented. Arnold was arraigned on multiple charges, including armed robbery, kidnapping, and conspiracy counts. His attorney denies the allegation, saying key claims rely on testimony from co-defendants who have entered plea agreements. The judge ordered Arnold held without bond as the case moves forward. So he'll be in jail this weekend, and then he'll be back in court on Monday for another detention hearing to see if he can get out. But he'll be spending the weekend in jail.
Yeah, but at least initially he was denied that bail.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, he's denied the bail. And, so they're relying on testimony from co-defendants. These guys have pled. They're testifying against them. Listen, I'm singing. If I get a lesser charge and I know you're the guy, I'm not going to just go down.
It doesn't look great.
It does not.
Just based on the information that we have.
It does not.
Yeah. The Tigers lose yesterday as well, 2-1 at home against Houston. And it's a shame because Troy Melton had a perfect game going into the sixth inning. And that was, a really nice outing for Troy Melton. And on the other side, Tatsuya Ime struck out 10 in six scoreless innings, too. So we had a pitching battle early on in that game, and they just couldn't come out with the win. Dylan Dingler was the only breakthrough. He had his 19th home run, so just couldn't get it done with the bats. The pitching
the bats
was there last night, unfortunately.
Yeah. See, and that's the thing, man. We get the bats going.
Get the bats going. This team looks a little different.
A couple of editorials yesterday in the Detroit News. One about the Democratic gubernatorial race and, the candidates, as we know, Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, Genesee County Sheriff Chris Swanson. And the piece criticizes Benson's tenure in office, pointing to issues with transparency, that troubled $9 million online disclosure system rollout, and court rulings against part of our election policy changes. It also raises concerns about FOIA delays and potential conflicts of interest tied to her family's business connections. By contrast, though, Chris Swanson is described by the Detroit News as a more moderate, results-driven candidate with decades of law enforcement experience and focus on management and accountability. The editorial concludes that among the Democratic candidates, the Detroit News is endorsing Chris Swanson for the August 4th primary. Now, for the GOP primary, you have businessman Perry Johnson, former Attorney General Mike Cox, Congressman John James, all running on the Republican side. The Detroit News notes that all three candidates are focused on improving education outcomes, strengthening school accountability, and advancing policies they say would support economic growth, including tax reform and reducing regulatory barriers. John James and Mike Cox are highlighted as the strongest contenders with similar positions on education and government efficiency. The editorial concludes, though, that among the candidates on the Republican side, the Detroit News has endorsed John James as the Republican primary candidate for governor.
Interesting. So Chris Swanson and John James.
Yes.
Pick up the endorsements of the Detroit News.
That is correct.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, I thought it was as well.
I mean, maybe a little less so for John James. You know, again, I would love to talk with them over there about how that process works.
Uh-huh.
Like, are they influenced by other, you know, endorsements that have come out or things like that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because John's been on a roll with those endorsements.
He really hasn't. He got the big endorsement just last week.
Right? Yeah. Interesting. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court issued a ruling on a couple of important topics, including they're allowing the federal government to move forward with ending temporary protected status for immigrants from countries including Haiti and Syria. That could put a lot of people at risk of losing their status for these TPS holders.
Mm-hmm.
Families could lose their legal work authorization. There could be deportation. There are concerns among business leaders that key industries like healthcare and construction could face labor shortages if these workers were forced to leave. Some of this stemmed from these earthquakes in different places, things
mm-hmm.
like that. But that was years ago.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that they were looking at is the T in TPS, temporary.
Oh, yeah.
It's not permanent protected status.
Yes.
It's temporary protected status. So one of the questions that they were asking was, well, how long does that last? What should be the length of that?
Yeah.
So that was one of the big decisions yesterday by the Supreme Court. They also cleared the way for the administration to enforce stricter asylum rules at the southern border, which will allow officials to turn away migrants who have not yet entered the United States. There's a long-running legal dispute over this.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not the government has the ability to limit the amount of people that are coming into the United States seeking asylum. One of the problems with these asylum seekers is many of them technically don't qualify for asylum.
Right.
But under, for example, the Biden administration, it was kind of carte blanche. People were saying, I'm seeking asylum. And then they were being let in, they were being processed, and they were being given a court date for later on.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to actually seek asylum, you have to be, not only do you have to feel fearful for your life, In your country,
yeah.
But you also have to prove that there is a danger to your life, that things are actually, like, this is a life and death situation.
Yeah.
And many of them were not, they were seeking asylum, but they didn't qualify under the asylum laws. So they tightened that up at the Supreme Court as well. But some pretty consequential decisions.
And still more to come. I mean, we still have birthright citizenship. We have transgender rights, mail-in voting, election law, campaign finance. Those are four that are still big, that are still haven't come through yet. So,
which, by the way, a birthright citizenship, I don't know. It seems to me that the Supreme Court will continue on with the rules.
With
the
rules.
Yeah, I don't see how the administration would come away with a win on that one.
That would be shocking if that happened.
Coming up on the other side, a court-appointed watchdog has accused Sean Fain of preferential treatment and retaliation. Brianna Noble joins us. It's Chair Morning. All right, here's your chance to win a trip to see two country superstars, Jason Aldean and Luke Bryan, in Vegas. Double the hits, one unforgettable night. We've got your flights, hotel, and concert tickets covered. The Double Down Tour, Aldean and Bryan co-headlining with special guests John Pardee and Chase Matthews, all live under the neon lights, prize provided by BBR Music Group. Texas Hour's national keyword, ROAD, to 95819. That's ROAD to 95819. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. Official rules and more info at WJR.com. Meanwhile, a court-appointed federal monitor overseeing the United Auto Workers found that union president Sean Fain engaged in, quote, a reoccurring pattern of retaliation and abused his authority, including actions that were tied to benefits and opportunities involving his fiance and her sister. The report that was filed in federal court this week also says that Fain removed senior union official Rich Boyer from overseeing Stellantis' operations for reasons that were, quote, unsupported and exaggerated, suggesting that the move was retaliatory. And all of this while there is a heated battle for the next president of the UAW heating up inside the union. Brianna Noble is the auto and business writer at the Detroit News and joins us this morning. Brianna, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, let's talk about how this report is interesting to me because I'm curious to know how much influence that a report like this has on the upcoming leadership election inside the union.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of questions about what sort of impact this might have on the selection of the union. The United Auto Workers last week had their quadrennial constitutional convention in Detroit, during which delegates from each of the locals came and nominated candidates for the international executive board positions, including president. So those nominations have been put out. So to have this right afterwards, I know some of the comments from statements from UAW President Sean Fain and the United Auto Workers itself, was questioning the timing of some of this. But a lot of these reports, many of the UAW members have, been used to kind of looking for these reports coming out and what they say, and obviously are interested in what the UAW monitor's decision has been. So this is definitely something that is talked amongst the rank and file, but ultimately we won't know what the ultimate impact on how UAW members are thinking about how these reports will shape what they want to see from the union in the future until that election this fall.
Well, Brianna, the monitor says there could also be disciplinary action, but no criminal charges are involved. What tools does he have available, and how significant could those actions be?
Yeah, the UAW monitor is able to, remove officers, leverage, different measurements of disciplines in response to some of his investigations. What the report said that he will be having conversations with the parties of the consent decree, which include the UAW as well as the U.S. Justice Department, regarding response to some of the investigations. Findings, so that is pending currently.
I'm interested in, it's one thing if you remove somebody from a job because you don't think they did a good job or there's a retaliatory nature, not appropriate, but I can understand that within the context of the structure of the organization. But some sort of financial benefit for his fiance or her family that were talked about in this report, what was specifically the issue there?
Yeah, there was a complaint filed by Vice President Rich Boyer in response to his removal from the head of the Stellantis department back in 2024 regarding some actions that he felt like he had been involved in denying, that he felt like the removal was in response to, and that included a bonus for some workers at the National Training Center where Saint's fiance worked. The investigation did not go into so many specific details on that part. It went into a little bit more details on a workers' compensation situation involving Saint's fiance's sister, in which there was actions taken or described to be taken by UAW President Sean Fain, involvement in this workers' compensation claim. And the situation is typically handled more at the local level. And so it was pointed out in the report that it was unusual to have such a high level influence. And in response to some of the actions that were taken on that, there was a suggestion that that amounted to sort of preferential treatment and abuse of authority because of that involvement.
And what happens next, Brianna? Does the monitor decide whether to pursue discipline before the election, or could this stretch well beyond the vote?
Yeah, there wasn't a timing provided on when we would potentially hear sort of an outcome from some of these investigations. The monitor stated in the report that he would be consulting the parties of the consent decree, which again include the UAW and the U.S. Justice Department. And so, pending that decision is when we would, receive information about sort of like next steps or, what the outcome of that is. But the election, will be in the fall. It'll be by mail-in ballot. So it'll happen over the course of a few months starting this fall.
I think we have like 18 months or so left on the oversight here from the federal government on the UAW. Is it possible that that gets extended?
The consent decree does specify at least 6 years. So yes, there isn't a chance of that. That could be extended, and that'll be part of a discourse between the court and all the parties involved.
Yeah, sure. Certainly. Brandon Noble, really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you. Have a good weekend. We'll talk soon.
You too.
Yeah, you got it. Coming up on the other side, why exactly, when we talk about the Declaration of Independence being such a great document, why is it maybe the most important statement in human history? We'll talk about it. It's next on J.R. Morning. So Thomas Jefferson spent between June 11th and June 28th in 1776, just 17 days, to write perhaps the greatest document ever created in human history. And it was obviously so influential because, Lloyd, up until the Declaration of Independence, leaders were kings and queens. They were people that thought they were given these powers by divine intervention. Mm-hmm. God gave them these powers. And what the Declaration of Independence did was flip it and said, no, we earn our power and then we protect the people.
Yes.
And what I don't know that most people realize, and this is why I think it probably, with all of its forward thinking and ability to morph into other things that would be able to adapt to modern day life, this living document, it also, it gave independence to these 13 colonies, but then they were able to work with other countries in their battle against the British.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if they were just 13 colonies under British control, they would have never been able to reach out to France and ask for help in liberating the people of the United States. It is such an incredible document, and let's talk about it. Dr. Matthew Spaulding is the VP of Washington Operations and the Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale College and joins us. Doc, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Even now, looking back 250 years later, what still surprises you either about the process or just the document in and of itself, the story surrounding it? What still surprises you to this day?
It's hard to say. So much surprises me. I've been teaching this for decades. I've just written a book on it. It is one of the most amazing documents in history, as you said. The fact that it could be put together so quickly, or tell us that how brilliant Jefferson was. He's a wonderful writer. But also keep in mind here that he wasn't inventing this. He was capturing this debate. Well, this debate had been going on for years and been building for at least a decade in pamphlets and writings. So he captured all this. I mean, it was an amazing moment when these colonists, they were reading, they were thinking, they were arguing, they're deliberating, and so they were becoming a people. And the Declaration of Independence captures that. So that's an amazing thing for us to understand. But then the other thing is, what makes the Declaration so much alive? What gives us that? Well, this is what makes America exceptional, why we are a different country. It wasn't, as you just said, breaking away from just the king. It was against the king. It was against that form of rule. It was radical in the sense that it went to the root of things. No, all men are created equal. And it said this was not merely their opinion. Didn't begin, "We hold it. We have a few subjective value statements we'd like to share with you." They said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." I mean, that was something unheard of. This had been building for thousands of years, the Greeks and the Romans, the Christian tradition, the notion that we are equal in the eyes of God, we are equal, have an equal status in humanity that gives us the right to consent to those that rule us. I mean, that transformed the whole world. And Jefferson captured this beautiful document. And at the moment when these Americans were about to be invaded, literally, by the British in Washington and New York, waiting to be attacked, at that very moment, in a matter of days, and this intense period, Jefferson put this together, and then they passed independence. And then 2 days later, on July 4th, they passed this beautiful document. To realize that, to realize the story, the intensity of it, and then read that document again, is just an amazing thing. I'm still amazed by it. All these after decades of teaching it, it's just a wonderful document, and beautifully, beautifully written.
Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness may be the most famous phrase in the document. Did the founders mean happiness the way we define happiness today?
Well, it depends on we. A lot of people think, pursuit of happiness is whatever makes you feel good, whatever you want to say is happiness.
So subjective, I guess, right?
There's very subjective okay. happiness. Uh-huh. That's not what they thought. So when they used the word happiness, they knew, as anybody would have known at the time, and we should know, happiness is the end of man in all Greek and Roman and Christian thinking. Happiness means substantive happiness, human flourishing, fulfillment of man, a man in the highest sense of happiness, so goodness and virtue. But also this is why the pursuit of happiness, what's the highest part of the pursuit of happiness they talk about quite a bit? That's our religious liberty. Pursuit of happiness means pursuing the highest things, a completion of fulfillment of man, which includes coming to know the truth about religion, about God, about divine things. So they had a much deeper, deeper sense of happiness that I think many of us still have, but we generally have lost. And that's not the way the Declaration is taught. It's usually taught, it's your happiness, and it's usually not taught that it's truth. These are your truth, your values. They were writing in a different world. And we should be trying to recover that world. And this is an opportunity to do so by going back and rereading it and studying the founders.
I mean, one of the things, and by the way, it is Founding Fathers Friday. We're talking John Adams coming up next. But I will say, it did seem that even at a time when slavery was very much still in the populace, there were abolitionists. There were people that knew that it was inherently wrong to own other people for the benefit of their work, their business. But this is the complicated part of these founding fathers, because many of them still owned slaves. Obviously, Jefferson was one of them.
Yes, right.
But did they inherently know that it was wrong, and that ultimately you would get to a day where people would be liberated, where people would be free, all men would be created equal?
Bill, fabulous question, and you're right on the point. What I find amazing about this document and that period is a lot of them owned slaves, including Jefferson. Jefferson owned many slaves at the time. Many of them did not. There were abolitionists that signed the Declaration. There were abolitionists at the Constitutional Convention. There were some, like George Washington, he had slaves. But he gave freedom to his slaves on his wife's death in his estate. There are several that actually ended up selling slaves because of what they came to know from the Declaration of Independence. They all knew, including Jefferson, that slavery was wrong. It violated the principle of human equality. Even the Southerners who wanted to keep their slaves knew ultimately that was the problem. So they knew they'd put in the Declaration essentially the seed, if you will, the piece of dynamite that would blow all this up. Its days were numbered. What they didn't know and what happened later was, for instance, the invention of the cotton gin changed the whole economics of slavery. That comes later. The founding They wanted to build a country, to start a country, to begin a country. And to begin the country, they couldn't get rid of it immediately. No one, there wouldn't be agreement. There wasn't unanimity. They would be divided. The British would probably then be able to defeat them by splitting them up. So instead, what they did is they unified, but they included the principle that all men are created equal. And that's what's revolutionary. That's what's that's the electricity of it, the power of it. That's what Martin Luther King went back to. That's what Frederick Douglass went back to. That's what Abraham Lincoln went back to. The principle is stated in 1776, and then it plays out. And yes, we fought a civil war to free the slaves.
Sure.
That's the great story here is not that America had slavery. It did. That's barbaric. The great story is that America overcame slavery and fought to defend the principles of the Declaration and to live up to them.
Dr. Matthew Spaulding at Hillsdale College, we appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much, and we'll talk again very soon.
Great, and happy 4th of July to everyone.
Yeah, yeah, you as well. We'll take a break. Founding Fathers Friday. Next, we're talking President John Adams. It's JR Morning. All right, so Founding Fathers Friday, and we've talked about a lot of them thus far as we get you ready for the 250th celebration of this grand experiment that is the United States of America. And our second president, John Adams, you know, there was a great docuseries. It was a great reenactment. And I can't remember who did it. It was on HBO. And it highlighted the life of John Adams and the relationship that he had with Thomas Jefferson.
Okay.
By the way, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson died on the same day. It was July 4th. It was 50 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. I think three of the first five presidents have died on July 4th.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
Different years, but same day.
John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, I believe, died on the same day.
In the same year?
On July 4th. Yes. On the same day.
Wow.
50 years after, to the day, 50 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And I think it was Madison. I don't remember. Regardless, John Adams was a consequential figure. Why? Because even go back to before the Revolution, before the presidency, there was a lot of information about Adams and the kind of man he was. So let's talk about him with Dr. Kurt Graham, the president of the Adams Presidential Center. Doc, good morning. It's great to have you.
Hey, thanks so much. Great to be with you. I heard your traffic report on the way in, and I thought it was the Boston report. All the construction and closing sounded very familiar. I thought I was on a local station.
Right. Well, thanks for hopping on with us this morning. I want to go back to what happened at the Boston Massacre, because John Adams defended these British soldiers who opened fire on these civilians who were pelting them with snowballs and rocks and oysters, things like that.
Yeah.
And they opened fire. They killed five citizens. But John Adams thought that they were getting a bad rap. He defended them and ultimately won. What did that say about his character?
Well, it says a lot of things about his character. It also says a lot of things about the conditions in the colonies at the time. I mean, Adams believed then, as he believed even later in the Revolution and into the early Republic, that the rule of law was paramount, that everyone needed and deserved a fair trial. Everyone needed to be represented. And so he's on the side of the crown, and this is in 1770, not necessarily a popular place to be in Boston at that time, but he said, you know, whatever it cost me personally. And by the way, he was one of the best lawyers in Boston. He had a thriving practice. So he had a lot to worry about, not just in terms of, you know, people throwing rocks through his windows or getting tarred and feathered or whatever could happen with mobs, but he stood to lose some business. But rather than that, he actually gained in reputation and in prowess because he did the right thing for the right reason. Now, this is 1770. You have to remember that no one is talking about independence, about breaking away from the crown. They're just saying, hey, there's some issues here we need to work through. And there's some things that we don't approve of and we don't like having soldiers in our city. You know, you talk about several thousand soldiers in a city that only had 15,000 residents at the time. So it felt very much like a police state to a lot of colonists. So Adams, you know, he says, hey, you know, look, we still need to defend these people. We need to do the right thing. He later reflected on this. He said it was the most manly thing he ever did to defend those soldiers because he felt it needed to be done. Kurt, it was definitely a bold move.
Kurt, John and Abigail Adams opposed slavery. John Quincy Adams spent much of his later life, yeah, fighting it. Why do you believe their story has particular relevance today?
Well, you know, when you think about the founding fathers, the first five presidents, for example, John Adams is the only one who did not hold slaves. Now, it would be wrong to equate Adams with a, you know, post-civil rights thinking American. I mean, he was not Martin Luther King. He was not necessarily advocating for that kind of equality at that time. But he was way ahead of a lot of his particularly Southern contemporaries. He knew that slavery was wrong, but he wasn't necessarily willing to throw down the gauntlet and in the way that John Quincy later did. That's, mm-hmm, that's an evolution across a generation, not just within a family, but within a country. But no, the fact that John and Abigail Adams did not own slaves, I think is very unique to today, because it points to an alternative path, that it's not a foregone conclusion that America was born as a slave-holding society. There were other people and other options and other opportunities. Those didn't necessarily win out in the 1780s and 90s, but ultimately through the work of John Quincy Adams, you know, Abraham Lincoln, others, and then, you know, we have the Jim Crow, and we're still wrestling with race relations in this country. But, you know, we owe it to people like John Adams that we made it as far as we did, certainly in that early time.
Yeah.
He met King George III. What was that meeting like?
Well, a little nerve-wracking for John Adams.
He's yeah,
the emissary. He's the ambassador to the court of St. James in London, and he goes to meet the king. And of course, now this is after the revolution. This is much later. This is in 1785. And he's a little, you know, I mean, he's the first American, certainly of his stature, to go and have an audience with the king. And he's thinking, well, you know, I was one of the responsible parties for breaking up the empire and taking away the colonies that George felt very badly about and very much lamented and regretted. And you know, John Adams and Abigail, unlike, you know, Jefferson and, you know, even Franklin to some degree. I mean, Franklin was, you know, came up through the ranks in a way that Jefferson was born into the ranks. Mm-hmm. But Adams, you know, as a farmer, he came up through as well. And so, you know, being in the court, being around royalty and nobility, it wasn't necessarily their comfortable go-to place. I mean, they were New England farmers. And so there was a little bit of social angst about it as well for Abigail and for John both. But for him, it was, you know, at least he wrote whether he thought that on the day or not. But that was a little scary.
The courage it took to enter that chamber is something else. Dr. Kurt,
what do you say to a guy like George? Hey, George, how's it going?
How are things? Dr. Kurt Graham, we appreciate your time and insight into our second president. Thank you for your time this morning.
Great to be with you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. Fascinating stories.
Man.
Yeah,
it really
fascinating
is.
Stories. 7 o'clock hours next. Well, tough night for the Stars and Bars. The United States loses to Turkey 3-2 in the World Cup. Their last game of group play didn't really matter because they're on to the next stage.
Exactly.
They've got a Wednesday date with Bosnia and Herzegovina, and that's the next round. So they were already through because they won their first two games. Australia also.
They're probably halfway checked out in that third game, so they're ready.
I think to go on to the next round. I think there was it was a different level of play. I don't think that they were really full tilt.
Yeah.
In that game, they looked a little different than they did the last couple.
Okay.
And you know, a lot of that credit could go to Turkey too. Good squad. They didn't make it out of play, so they were going home.
Yeah.
But regardless,
they had nothing to lose. They were just playing, man.
Correct.
At the point. You
correct
know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Correct. So, they end up losing that game. I would prefer they didn't play like that again, but that's just my preference.
It won't end well if they do.
Yeah, here's my breakdown of the game. Please don't play like that again. That'd be great.
Everything else is fine. But just don't play like that.
Don't do that again.
Okay.
And we'll be okay.
All right.
Tigers also lose last night 2-1 at home against the Houston Astros. It's a shame because Troy Melton had a perfect game going into the sixth inning. It was a bit of a pitcher's duel, and Dylan Dingler's 19th home run on the year was the only saving grace.
You know, we have a lot of these, you know, 2-1, 3-2, 4-3 type of games, you know, where, you know, our pitching does pretty well. We just can't get those bats going.
Yes. Yes. You know? And some of those days when the pitching's a little loose,
yeah,
hitting picks up a little bit, just can't quite get it all together on the same page. Yeah.
Yeah. Detroit Lions cornerback Terrion Arnold was in a Florida courtroom yesterday following his arrest in that violent kidnapping and robbery case tied to an incident back in February. Tampa Bay police say three victims were allegedly beaten, held at gunpoint, pistol whipped during a robbery involving more than $250,000 in stolen property. Investigators allege Arnold coordinated with several co-defendants after reporting the theft, then helped arrange contact with one of the victims and lured him into an apartment that he had rented. Now, Arnold was arraigned on multiple charges, including armed robbery, kidnapping, and conspiracy counts. His attorney denies the allegations, saying the key claims rely on testimony from co-defendants who have entered plea agreements. The judge ordered Arnold held without bond as the case moves forward.
Hmm.
So he's in jail. He'll be there at least over the weekend until they have another detention hearing next week, and they'll decide whether, you know, he stays behind bars until the trial or if he gets out on bond.
Yeah. Interesting.
The 4th of July, as we know, is coming up. And a lot of people like to, you know, shoot off fireworks. Well, Michigan officials say they seized a massive cache of illegal fireworks and explosive materials following a multi-phase investigation involving multiple public safety agencies. The Michigan Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs says about 17,000 pounds of materials were confiscated, including roughly 1,200 pounds of overloaded devices falsely labeled as consumer-grade fireworks, another 5,000 pounds of professional-grade 1.3G display explosives. Authorities say the materials include large aerial shells intended only for trained and licensed professionals, posing serious risk if stored or used improperly. State officials, including Detroit's bomb squad and police in Garden City, took part in the operation. Laura says the seizure prevents potential fires, injuries, and catastrophic damage, calling the materials a significant public safety threat. I mean, when you have the Detroit bomb squad and Garden City bomb squad have to remove all these fireworks, I mean, come on. This is like Zambelli fireworks that people, you know.
The only people qualified to fire those off are the Zambellis.
Exactly. You can't be at home at, you know.
Could you imagine lighting one of those off in the cul-de-sac?
Dude, no way.
What?
No way. And you just don't want things to fall down
so
on the roof
properly,
or something?
They were improperly labeled?
Yes.
So they were overpacked and improperly labeled,
making it seem like, oh, these are safe. These are, you know.
Yeah, like you could buy one of those tents.
Exactly.
On the side of the road.
There you go. Oof. But they were actually the big shells. So
yikes.
Glad they got those off the street.
For real.
Because
that could be really dangerous.
I mean, we know people who have hurt themselves. And a lot. I mean, look at my weather friend over there at Channel 7 who lost his eye to fireworks.
Yes.
You know, so these fireworks can be dangerous. And something like this, you know, out cold.
When we were at the fireworks, Jake was like, are fireworks dangerous? And I'm like, yeah, man. Yeah, they're dangerous. That's why they're out on a barge in the middle of the river.
A lot of water around.
Because they're dangerous. That's why. I've always thought about, like, should we get some fireworks for the kids and light them off? And maybe some little ones, those, they freak me out.
Well,
they do.
In my neighborhood, there are some people who like 4th of July and shoot those rockets off because we have this big park at the end of my block, and they go to the park and they shoot them off. What I'm afraid of, though, is a lot of times, you know, what goes up comes down, must come down.
Sure.
And something is still lit and it falls on your roof, or if you have a lot of trees or, you know, shrubbery around and it falls down and catches fire, that's what I fear.
You know, my analysis of the U.S. play last night is the same thing here. Just don't do that.
Yes. Just don't do that. Have fun, but just don't do that, right?
Oof.
No, that's bad. The University of Michigan Board of Regents approved a $3.1 billion budget that includes tuition increases, higher room and board costs, new cost-cutting measures across campus. Under the plan, the in-state undergraduate tuition will rise about 3% or roughly $275 a term, while out-of-state graduate students will see increases of closer to 4.9%. Room and board will also go up about 6%. this fall. University leaders say the budget reflects financial uncertainty tied to state funding, research support, international enrollment, and rising mandatory costs like employee health care. Officials also expect flat state appropriations, which they say effectively act as a cut.
Interesting. 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. It's no secret that, with all of the inflationary pressure facing consumers these days, we're cutting back on spending. But one area that is actually benefiting from the current economic circumstances is that of private label goods, specifically private label groceries, driven, of course, by the cost savings associated with private label versus big brand goods. FMI, the Food Industry Association's new annual private label report, finds that 92% of U.S. shoppers now have private label products in their home. That's up from 89% last year. Private brand dollar sales increased 2.8% for the year, compared to a gain of 2.6% for national brands. That according to data from Circana. The data further shows that almost half of consumers increased their store brand purchases over the past year, while only 31% say they've purchased more national brands. And of course, given the economic conditions today, it's no surprise that people are shopping with a cost-conscious focus. But what is surprising is that consumers are making the choice to switch to private label, not just because of lower prices. Nearly all shoppers, 94% to be exact, say they are likely to keep buying store brands, those private label brands, even if grocery prices begin to decline. Improved quality and perception are cementing the new preferences for private label brands, with 37% of shoppers saying they buy these products based on quality and they're going to stick with them. Perceptions of quality for private label brands have risen from 30 to 39% over the last year. Now, Tom Cosgrove, Director of Industry Relations for FMI, offered this comment with the report: consumers aren't just choosing store brands out of habit or necessity. They're choosing them because they've earned the trust and loyalty of American families. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
All right, well, despite the U.S.'s loss to Turkey 3-2 last night, very late game, 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
That game started.
People were talking about that it would be so late. That it would be a little hungover this morning.
Well, but you know what? To be fair, all these other countries across the pond and around the world, they're all staying up at ungodly hours as well to watch their countries as well. So we can take a 10 o'clock kickoff.
Oh, absolutely.
On the West Coast. That's all right.
I mean, we played basketball at 9 o'clock, right?
Right.
Like 9:30.
Exactly. Or remember when the Red Wings were in the Western Conference?
Yes, yes.
Those West Coast trips, those 10:30 puck drops.
Ugh.
Tough. But regardless of the outcome last night, and the United States did lose, they had won their first two games, so they were already on to the group of 32. But there are still some things that we got to settle in group play, and that'll bear itself out today, tomorrow, and then Sunday we get into the round of 32.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great new spot here in the city of Detroit to catch all of the World Cup games, and that is at the Regal Eagle. And Keith Baldwin, the co-owner, rejoins us once again this morning. Keith, it's good to have you back.
Hey, good to be back.
First of all, business is still good. Business is booming. It's World Cup time, and you're the place to come check it out.
Yeah, there's been quite a vibe, quite an atmosphere for a lot of the games. Been very busy for the Mexico-USA games. Brazil's been showing up big, and we've had people from every nation come in and watch the games.
And, you know, for people who may not follow soccer year-round, what do you think has made this World Cup so compelling so far?
I think it's a big celebration, and people, I think, are feeling that. A lot of the fans are partying together. You see in the stadiums in the cities, they're partying together before the game. Soccer fans have always kind of been a bit separate from different clubs, from different nations, but it's really been a big coming together and partying. And I think it's nice to have an event where no matter if you're supporting different teams, you can all celebrate together, right?
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah,
meanwhile, for the U.S. last night, outcome didn't really matter. They were already on to the next round. But it was good to see Christian Pulisic get some time, some playing time. He was out with that injury. And it felt like you wanted to at least get him on the pitch, give him some time on the field, and then get ready for this next game against Bosnia.
Yeah, he definitely was good. He got some minutes, because if he hadn't played last night, that would be quite a gap between game one and game four for him. So it was good for him to get out there and play. And yeah, I'm not worried about the result last night. The aim was to win the group, and the USA won the group.
Do you think American soccer fans have become more knowledgeable over the years, especially with the World Cup being played here in North America?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I definitely think they have. Quite a lot of the American soccer fans like to be quite analytical about things, their sports, and I think a lot of them have dove straight into soccer and broken it down in lots of ways.
Do you I'm curious, because there's always this narrative that soccer isn't as popular in the United States as it is in other countries around the world, which of course is true. We have other sports that get elevated oftentimes. But even if we operate on the assumption that there's 360 million Americans, and let's say a fourth of them are tuning into these games, I mean, that's still 90 million people. It's still a massive amount of people that are watching these games, that are invested, that are going. It feels like, and maybe this is just recency bias, but it feels like there is a lot of excitement around this and this U.S. team.
Yeah, I think in a way that's kind of become the narrative that people have told themselves the last 20, 30 years that soccer isn't as popular. But over the past 20 years, more kids play soccer than any other sport in America. Mm-hmm. So the groundswell of that, and they've now become young adults. Soccer is extremely popular. The attendances at MLS games have only gone up. The World Cup's only going to boost that. And soccer is very much part of the fabric of America now.
Even in the city of Detroit.
I'm everywhere.
With Detroit City FC.
When I go to parks and neighborhoods, there's always a soccer game going on. There's a kid's soccer game going on. And watching soccer, Keith, in a pub is really very different from watching at home. Do you see fans from, like, different countries coming together at the Regal Eagle? And what does that kind of add to the experience when you're watching these games?
Yeah, well, watching it together is sets you up for that sense of community. When you watch it at home, and sometimes I've wanted to watch games at home because I wanted to lock in and really focus on a certain game, but that's why we set up our screens a certain way at the Regal Eagle, is we want you to be able to watch it, to hear the sound, to be able to not only lock in if you're very focused or stressed about the outcome of a game, but then you can share that with everybody, and you can share the joy, or you can comfort each other. But you can see the game and hear it clearly, and in a way, it is better to watch it together.
Do you have plenty of ranch on hand, plenty of beer on hand?
Well, the ranch has been making an appearance, but more where we're at, there's lots of salsa for the tacos.
Definitely.
Yeah, but there's a lot of beer. There's a lot of beer, and there's a lot of beer from American, Mexican, European beer, and many more drinks as well.
When you look at this weekend's schedule, are there matches that, has the potential to completely change the tournament?
Not to change the tournament, but to round out the round of 32. I think it's going to be a tournament where we're going to see an African team really make a big impact. Last World Cup, Morocco got to the semifinals.
Yeah.
They're already through. Ivory Coast is through. And I wouldn't give up on Senegal yet. They've lost both their games, but they are African champions. If they beat Iraq by 2 or 3 goals, that could put them in as a third-place finisher, and there would be a team nobody really wants to face in the last 32.
Really quickly, we have just a minute left here. Talk about what we can expect now from this tournament into the round of 32, out of the group stages. You don't have those three games. How does this structurally work now?
Well, now this is where the bit of the tension comes in. So there'll still be a lot of feel-good feeling, but it's going to be tension with fans, because now if you lose this celebration of the World Cup that you're in, you're no longer in it. And that's a very empty feeling when the final whistle goes and you know your team's eliminated. So there's going to be some great matchups. There's a lot on the line of all those matchups, and it's going to be an exciting next week.
You like this U.S. matchup?
Yeah, Bosnia are a team that could definitely cause some problems, but when you look at who the U.S. could face, I think Bosnia is a team you would probably pick. So that's definitely a team we expect the USA to win, but nobody's going to be a pushover. But
no
if
doubt.
The USA play like we know they can, Canada have a great draw against South Africa as well. Mexico, if they play in Mexico City, and if they win, they play again in Mexico City. So location-wise, they've got a great route and to go deep as well.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's the Regal Eagle. It's a place to be. Keith Baldwin's the co-owner. We appreciate your time as always. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the patronage, and we'll talk again soon.
Will do. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you got it. You got it. Fun weekend coming up. But he's right. The tension rises. Uh-huh. Because you lose, you're done.
You're done. Win or go home.
Win or go home. Yeah. So certainly the tension skyrockets. Coming up on the other side, Michigan lawmakers pushing to cut cargo theft and gift card scams. It's coming up on JR Morning. So there's a new initiative centered at Michigan Central, which is aiming to combat this problem of organized retail crime. It's coordinated, it's sophisticated, and it's this idea of a cargo hub where retailers and law enforcement, they share real-time data and intelligence on, mm-hmm. on the whereabouts of these items in these cargo hubs. But the idea is to target theft, not just at the store level. That's
right.
A problem in and of itself.
Sure.
But even before it gets there, trying to avoid these supply chain issues mm-hmm. that we've seen. Let's talk about it. William Hallin is the president and CEO of the Michigan Retailers Association and joins us this morning. William, it's great to have you.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
So people that you represent, retailers, are saying that organized crime is getting more sophisticated, more coordinated. What are the gaps that you're working with lawmakers on to avoid these, you know, high-profile retail thefts?
Yeah, really appreciate that. Organized retail crime should definitely be distinguished from ordinary shoplifting. It is large-scale theft with the intent to resell the items for financial gain. And what happens is they use that money to further other criminal illicit activities like human trafficking, terrorism, and drug smuggling. The problem is this is not just happening in Michigan. It's happening across the borders. It's happening across state lines. So we really need federal legislation to help combat this problem.
You know, a lot of these stolen products eventually end up online. Has e-commerce platforms like made it easier for organized criminals to move these stolen goods?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and the Inform Act was passed in Michigan, and it was passed by Congress a couple years ago, which is to help crack down on the sale of illicit items on marketplaces. But you're always trying to catch up with the criminals, and they're always thinking one step ahead. And the problem is, if you're a consumer and you're buying that good, you don't always know if it's counterfeit, if it's been stolen.
Right.
So you don't know what product you're getting. So we want to make sure consumers are protected as well.
How is Lansing getting involved?
We've been doing a lot in Michigan. Michigan's actually probably the leader in organized retail crime. Mm-hmm. Right now we have a bill that's passed through the House and it's on the Senate floor, which would add gift card fraud to our organized retail crime statute. And what criminals are doing with gift card fraud is they'll take a gift card off the shelf, they'll manipulate the data on it, and then they'll put it back on the shelf. So when a consumer goes in and they buy it, the criminal is notified immediately, and they're able to pull the money off of it. So then you go to use your gift card, and it has no money on it. So we're trying to add that to our existing organized retail crime statute. And then we're working with the Attorney General
as well.
Quickly,
how are they doing that?
Oh, my gosh. Well,
or maybe you don't want to give away the goods. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know exactly what mechanism they use to be able to manipulate the data, but they're able to basically play with the mag strip and all the data on the gift card so that as soon as you load it with money, they get notified and they wipe it. And then they put it back on the shelf. So it's a huge issue.
How much are retailers investing in security and technology and loss prevention simply just to keep up with these sophisticated theft operations?
It's a huge line item for retailers. I mean, ORC costs American retailers about $69 billion per year and Michigan retailers about $2.3 billion a year. So and the problem is when ORC happens, I mean, eventually those losses do flow to the consumer ultimately because a retailer has to be profitable. And if they're having losses in one area of their business, they have to increase prices, and that's certainly something I think every Michigander is sensitive to right now.
Yeah.
Hypothetically, if you were to cut brick and mortars out of the equation, would this theft go down?
So what's interesting is in Michigan right now, about 20% of total retail sales are online, which is about 4% higher than the national average. So what we want is we want excellent brick and mortar sales in Michigan. We want people to be intentional and think about purchasing online or think about purchasing at a brick and mortar store in Michigan and not just online. Online can supplement what they're doing, but I don't think pushing people online is a good result for Michigan's economy.
And if listeners think this issue doesn't affect them because they say, look, I'm not a retailer, what's the biggest misconception about organized retail crime that you like to change?
I think the biggest misconception is it's that it's not shoplifting. I mean, ORC is not an opportunistic crime by a teenager that's looking to steal a candy bar or a shirt from a popular store for personal gain. It is organized on a large scale, and they're stealing items at large volume, like you mentioned at the top of this interview, cargo theft, and then they're using those goods to further other even more dangerous criminal activities. And that's what people don't understand. This is not small-scale theft.
We just have 30 seconds left here. Are these organized crime organizations, are they originating in the United States? Are they from, adversarial countries? Who's doing this?
It's all across the board, honestly. I mean, you have outside countries doing it. You have teams in all the states that are doing it as well, and they kind of move up the eastern seaboard. And that's why we need coordination between state and federal government so that they have a solution to be able to combat this.
Mm. William Hallin, it's a problem. We appreciate you and others that are looking at it. Thank you for your time this morning. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, but those gift cards, man.
That's crazy.
Oh, definitely.
You know what I saw the other day, though? If you gone to a gas station and at your pump, it'll say, scan here and use Apple Pay or Google Pay or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I we should look into this, but I had seen a story that basically said those are phony. Like, if you are going to use your phone to tap or scan the QR code, you just scan the actual tap place on the pump.
On the pump, that's right.
You wouldn't use that.
Mm-mm.
I had seen that those were phony. They're not real. They're not tied to the gas station. People just come and put those stickers down. When you scan them, they have access to your money now.
You got
to
be careful when you do that, because a lot of these have these card readers that capture this information that are stuck on the pump, and you're sticking your card in, but you're really going through this card reader that they put on and stuff. And
we should look into that to make sure that that's legitimate.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, coming up on the other side, a first-of-its-kind forum on UAPs. Bunch of folks getting together. We'll talk about it on the other side. But first at 7:44, time for Automotive Views with Mike Martinez. It's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Learn more at michiganbusiness.org.
Give credit where it's due. Ford Motor Company rose to become the top-rated mass-market brand in J.D. Power's annual initial quality study. The Dearborn automaker has struggled for years with vehicle defects, high recalls, and costly warranties, but a methodic turnaround plan took them to the top of this year's rankings. How'd they do it? Daily problem-solving sessions that would focus on an individual issue until it was fixed, a new organizational structure that streamlined workflows, and rehiring hundreds of veteran specialists to fix problems that AI systems were getting wrong, plus a few key hires. Bryce Curry, a manufacturing executive from Johnson Controls, instituted bus tours of Ford's plants to share best practices. Liz Dorr, chief supply chain officer from Whirlpool, got more buy-in from Ford's suppliers. Ford desperately needed to solve its quality problems. Recalls are still high, but this ranking is a big sign that things are looking up. With this week's Automotive View, I'm Mike Martinez with Automotive News.
Well, it was a first-of-its-kind UAP forum, the Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena, disclosure forum in Washington, D.C. There were lawmakers, researchers, whistleblowers that were pushing for greater government transparency around mysterious aerial sightings. Some of those that participated said that there has been progress made, but the federal government still withholding key information, fueling this public frustration about whether or not there are answers that that our taxpayers are going to solve.
Yeah.
And we're not getting the information as those that are funding these programs. And lawmakers took the time at this event to talk about legislation that would protect whistleblowers who come forward with UAP-related information. Let's talk about it. William Konkoleski is the state director of the Michigan chapter of the Mutual UFO Network and joins us. William, good morning. It's good to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
It seemed that a lot of the conversations talked about some sort of protections for whistleblowers. How much of that piece of the puzzle is at play here?
Well, I believe that with this secrecy going on probably about 80 years, as they claim, going back to the 1940s, that there have been a lot of people that have been read in, have participated in projects that have studied the UAP phenomena, and as they mentioned several times, have actually worked with technology recovered from these sort of things. So there are a lot of potential whistleblowers out there. And there was that one great moment where Gallaudet said, Timothy Gallaudet, the admiral from the Navy, when people were saying like, well, you know, you can't really keep a secret for this long. And Gallaudet's like, yes, you can. In the military, yes, you can. And so I think that releasing whistleblowers from talking about this, from allowing them to discuss this publicly, it's possible the floodgates will open and we'll have many, many people willing to talk about this that have been holding secrets for a very long time.
You know, as notable that senators and House members from both parties are participating, do you feel that we've reached a point where UAP research is moving from the fringe into, you know, the institutional science, or is it still a work in progress?
Definitely a work in progress. I really think that not only has the general public still not really paid much attention to this phenomena, but these lawmakers that are invested in it, I think this topic is somewhat new to them mm-hmm. as well. And so I think the conversation is still shaping. And somebody who is just casually paying attention, marginally paying attention to the phenomena, still doesn't really understand the conversation. And so one of the things I thought was great about the forum is they not only had lawmakers talking about it, but scientists. They also had psychologists, people talking about the financial industry and, you know, just all sorts of different topics. They even had somebody in there talking about the religious implications. I think they set the table really nicely.
You know, one of the things that was spelled out in The Age of Disclosure, one of the documentaries recently released that talked to people who worked on these programs within the federal government. And they had people like Marco Rubio, uh-huh. Kristen Gillibrand, a number of Tim Burchett, another member of Congress. So these aren't, you know, the folks that say, oh, I saw it out over a field in, you know, middle of Michigan. And these were people with credible backgrounds and credentials that were talking about this subject. And the Disclosure Foundation, which had organized this forum yesterday, unveiled polling that said the public wants greater transparency about this. 90% of Republicans and Democrats who responded said that they want the government to release more information about UAPs. That's a staggering number in 2026. 90% of people are on board with something.
Right. You know, I would venture that if they said, you know, they want the government to be more transparent on any subject,
it's fair.
Probably
fair. Yeah, fair.
But one thing I really have to jump in and say that was historic about this, and it was brought up several times. First, Kirk McConnell brought it up, and later Jordan Flowers brought it up. And then they actually had Whitley Strieber come out. Talking about that the people, the citizens, not anybody related to military or government, but the person on the streets, the grassroots level, those individuals who have claimed contact with beings from elsewhere. There were several little mentions of this, and having Whitley Strieber out there, I think, was a big deal. He is an experiencer, as they say. He claims to have been abducted by extraterrestrials. They closed out the the conference with him talking. So I really think you want to talk about opening the floodgates if they are indicating that they're willing to listen to people who have claimed contact. This is going to become a very interesting conversation.
No doubt about that. William Konkoleski, thank you so much for your time this morning. We appreciate it. Never would I have thought we'd be getting this type of forum in Washington, D.C. on a topic like this. But it's interesting to see. Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Yeah.
If we could just see the smile on your face.
Look, it's fascinating to me. And again, maybe it's nothing. It could be totally nothing. But it seems like there's a lot of secrecy.
Well, it does.
And maybe you just don't want to give away the goods and what you know to your adversaries, things like that. 8 o'clock hour coming up at Sharemore. All right, 8 o'clock hour. Good to have you. Team USA loses to Turkey 3-2 last night, but that's okay because they're on to the round of 32 Wednesday out in San Francisco, and they've got Bosnia-Herzegovina.
And they'll take care of that.
And I hope so.
They'll do it.
Everything.
They won't play like they did yesterday.
No, they can't play like they did yesterday.
They won't. That's they were sure. Half checked out yesterday.
That's kind of what it felt like. They were checked out. They got that early goal to start the game. I mean, within the first 6 minutes.
Yeah.
But no, they just, it was kind of a lackadaisical approach for them, which is fine. I think they'll ratchet it up again come Wednesday. But this thing turns up now. The heat's up in the kitchen, and you lose and you go home.
Yep.
It's very simple. So now. This thing dials up, and it's going to be a lot of fun. We got a couple more group games today and tomorrow, I believe, and then we get into the round of 32. But, yeah, it's been fun.
Tarion Arnold was in a Florida courtroom yesterday following his arrest in that violent kidnapping and robbery case tied to an incident back in February. The police in Tampa Bay say three victims were allegedly beaten, held at gunpoint, pistol whipped during a robbery involving more than $250,000 in stolen property. Investigators alleged Arnold coordinated with several co-defendants after reporting the theft, and then he helped arrange contact with one of the victims and lured him to an apartment he had rented. Arnold was arraigned on multiple charges, including armed robbery, kidnapping, conspiracy counts. His attorney denies the allegations. He told the court, he says, listen, these key claims are, you know, just relying on testimony from co-defendants who've already entered plea agreements. Judge ordered Arnold to be held without bond as the case moves forward. There will be another detention hearing next week to determine if he will get bond. But as of now,
he's
spend this weekend.
He's in the clink. Tigers lose yesterday 2-1 against the Astros down at Comerica Park. Troy Melton had a perfect game going into the sixth inning, but it wasn't enough. Dylan Dingler hit his 19th home run on the year, a single shot. And that was it for the Tigers. They lose 2-1 and now sit at 34-47 on the year. They've lost three straight.
Got to get those bats going.
Get them going.
We can't get them. It seems like we can't get the pitching and the bats going at the same time.
It would be nice to get everything.
you know?
It's like trying to drive a car when your driver's side front wheel's going forwards and your driver's or the passenger side on the front is going backwards. Yeah, you ain't going to get very far.
No, you're not. A couple of editorials in the Detroit News talking about who the Detroit News is supporting for governor on both the Democratic side and the Republican side. And on the Democratic side, as we know, the candidates are Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson and Genesee County Sheriff Chris Swanson. The editorial piece criticizes Benson's tenure in office, pointing to issues with transparency, a troubled $9 million online disclosure system rollout, and court ruling against parts of her election policy changes. By contrast, Swanson, described as a more moderate, results-driven candidate with decades of law enforcement experience and a focus on management and accountability, the editorial concludes that among the Democratic candidates for governor, the Detroit News is endorsing Chris Swanson.
Mm.
Now, on the Republican side, as you know, you have businessman Perry Johnson, you have former Attorney General Mike Cox, and you have Congressman John James. It notes all three candidates are focusing on improving education outcomes, strengthening school accountability, and advancing policies they say would support economic growth. John James and Mike Cox are highlighted as the strongest contenders with similar positions on education and government efficiency and business development. But the editorial concludes that among the candidates on the GOP side, the Detroit News is endorsing John James in the Republican primary for governor.
As DJ Khaled would say, another one.
Another one.
For John James. Another endorsement for him. He's been racking them up, especially culminating with Donald Trump's endorsement of his campaign.
And Chris Swanson, not only the Detroit News, but the Teamsters as well.
Yeah, he's picked up some support as well. It's interesting. I mean, he's got some work to do.
He definitely does.
He is lagging behind. But, you know, again, these polls are, you take them with a grain of salt.
Sure.
Across the board.
Yeah.
Senator Alyssa Slotkin was on Stephen A. Smith's Sirius XM show.
Uh-huh.
And she said a couple of things that I think are interesting. She says that the Democratic Party never recovered after its loss in 2024. Certainly not.
I agree with that.
Certainly not.
I can agree.
And she says that the party is in need of new leadership. She said that there is a debate within the party every day about the path forward. That's why I believe we need significant new leadership. The old models are no longer working, and that includes the Democratic Party. She was talking more about the political landscape in Washington writ large.
Yeah.
So she's talking about Republicans and Democrats. Mm-hmm. But she says specifically that the Democrats need new leadership. Now, of course, we've seen Hakeem Jeffries come under fire for his leadership in the House. Certainly Chuck Schumer has come under fire for his leadership in the Senate, particularly when it came to some of these government shutdowns.
And we see what's happening in New York with Mondami and the groups that he's pushing, those candidates.
Yeah, and she said that one of the reasons why they lost in 2024 was because Donald Trump came out and said, I'm going to make your life better. I'm going to make things cheaper. And things have gotten too expensive, so we're going to make sure that you keep more of your money. Great message. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that happens on the back end is a different story.
Yeah.
Right? We're still in the middle of this term for him. But that was the message. It was a clear message to people. It's why in New York, people were voting for Donald Trump and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
That's
on
right.
On the same ticket.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And this thing in New York with Mamdani, I think it is causing some concern for Democrats.
Absolutely. It is.
Because, and you can throw in Abdul Al-Sayed here.
Uh-huh. Yes.
I don't think that many in the Democratic Party want to move that direction. I don't think that's the case.
I agree. And a lot of people think that this is just the New York thing, that it wouldn't play in other states.
But Alyssa Slotkin's a smart politician.
She is.
And so what she's seeing is that we don't need to move further left. That's not how we're going to gain support. It's not how we're going to rebuild the party. Mm-mm. We need to come back. And she says the same thing about Republicans, but she's a Democrat.
Yeah.
Speak
on her party. Yeah.
We don't need to go the socialist route. We need to come back towards the middle.
The Detroit Jazz Festival set to return to downtown Detroit over Labor Day weekend, and organizers calling it one of the most ambitious editions yet. Now in its 47th year, the world's largest free jazz festival will once again feature global headliners, rising stars, and dozens of performances across the city. A major change this year, the festival will be fully centered at Hart Plaza, bringing three main stages together to create a more connected experience. Additional programming will take place at Wayne State University's Gretchen C. Vallade Jazz Center. Organizers say the move is designed to streamline the footprint while maintaining the same number of performances and keeping the event free to the public.
Cool.
Always a great time downtown at the Jazz Fest.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Coming up on the other side, the NFL draft is in the books.
Mm-hmm.
The NBA draft is in the books.
Mm-hmm.
And now on tap, the NHL draft. That starts tonight. We'll talk to Kevin Porter, the head coach of the U18 team at USA Hockey. Next, it's JR Morning. 7 o'clock tonight, ESPN. Round one of the NHL draft is tonight. And we've got a top 10 prospect here in the state of Michigan. And that comes the way of USA Hockey's National Team Development Program. And his name is Wyatt Cullen. Of course, his father, Matt, played in the NHL,
yeah.
Won a few Stanley Cups, coupled with our co-host's team, the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Uh-huh.
And all eyes are always on the U.S. developmental program in Plymouth. They do. They've got the best developmental program in the world. Everybody wants to copy it, and it's because of the success that they've had. And Kevin Porter is the head coach of the U18 team at USA Hockey and joins us this morning. Kevin, it's great to have you.
Yeah, guys, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So Wyatt has had a bit of a roller coaster here in the state of Michigan. He was banged up to start the year, missed 22 games with an injury, went a tremendous growth spurt at just 17 years old. But you guys looked like a completely different team on the ice after he came back from this injury. And he's really turned his game into a much more complete style of play, it seems like.
Yeah, he's a pretty special player. Obviously, he had a couple injuries that set him back a little bit. You kind of talked about that growth spurt. But, when they come in at 16, 15, 16, 17 years old, they're still growing. And I think he came in around 5'4 and left at about 6'1. So he obviously had a pretty big growth spurt there, and that affected him a little bit on the ice early on. And then I think once he got a little more comfortable, he got a little more confident, and like I said, he's a special player. And once he was healthy and started to play some games and build some confidence, he really took off and helped our team.
When you look at the draft, what are teams prioritizing most now? Is it just pure skill, hockey IQ, or adaptability in this rapidly changing league?
Yeah, I think it's going to be different for every team. Everyone wants that highly skilled goal scorer that can put the puck in the back of the net and they can trust and rely on. Some teams are looking for, a number one defenseman that can log 25, 30 minutes a night, and you can kind of build a team around it. It kind of depends on the team's needs. A lot of teams are looking for those highly skilled goal scorers. It's hard to score goals in the NHL. And if you can find someone that can, produce points and score, they're highly sought after.
Oh, obviously Wyatt Cullen is one of the players that we'll be watching for tonight, but what other players on the roster you think are going to be elevated in the next couple of days?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of them. We had some great players. We had a really great team. I think Casey Mutrin, will be up there, and Victor Plant and Mikey Burchild. There's a lot of guys, Luke Shire, Brady Noling, that's in net. I could list off, a majority of the team there that are probably going to get drafted this weekend. We had a pretty special team, and it's exciting to see these guys or get to see these guys get drafted and kind of live out their dream.
And when you work with these young players, how do you balance teaching them to love the game with the reality that they're entering a business where you got contracts and cap space and trades that can define their future?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's they come in and they love the game, and we kind of have to teach them, a little bit how to play a little more structured hockey. But I think the biggest thing for me is that the higher you get, the more of a business it is, and the less fun it becomes. I mean, playing in the NHL is a ton of fun, but there are a lot of expectations. You're getting paid, and there's a lot more stress. And I basically tell the guys, this is going to be the most fun you're going to have playing hockey probably moving forward. You get to college, there's a little more stress. Mm-hmm. There's more expectations. And then as soon as you get into pro, you got to produce and you got to play well every night. And that gets stressful, and those expectations can weigh on you a little bit. So I like to build a culture where guys can come to the rink and have fun and enjoy it, especially at this age, at 16 and 17 years old. There's no reason, you should be super stressed out and just come to the rink and have fun and enjoy it every day.
Our sports wrap will be out there doing their show for night one of the NHL draft out at USA Hockey Arena. You guys do such a fantastic job with these players that they are ready for that next chapter when they're called upon. Kevin Porter, we appreciate you as always. Thank you for your time. Enjoy tonight, and we'll talk again soon.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you got it, of course. Very cool. Yeah. The job that they do with those guys is...
It's amazing.
I mean, it's not just in the weight room. It's not just on the ice. I mean, they get trained. They get media training. Mm-hmm. They get trained how to handle themselves. you know, they're with billet families, so they stay in the community. They're out and about, and yeah.
That's very important.
Such a wonderful program out in Plymouth. All right, let me ask you this.
Okay.
We've heard all the stories, the ranch and the Bucky's trips and the people yeah. going to eat barbecue and all this, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, there are foods that you can buy at these World Cup matches, and I want to know, yes or no, would you eat these?
Okay.
Okay, Brian, you can certainly be in on this and as well. Abby, if you wanna hop on as well. All right, in Miami, they're selling fancy AF tots.
AF tots?
AF, fancy AF.
Okay.
I can't say what
I know what you mean, yeah. Tots, though.
Tots. Here's what they are.
Like tater tots?
They are three fried hash browns topped with caviar, creme fraiche, and chives. You in on that?
I don't know if I'm in on that.
I'm in on that. $75 is the price tag on
that. I haven't tasted caviar, so.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh, you got to get on caviar.
Yeah.
The Empanada Mundial, also in Miami. It's a 5-pound chicken and cheese empanada.
Yep.
For $40.
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
Lloyd's in on that.
Yep.
You guys in on that? Thumbs up, thumbs down?
Not with the caviar.
No, on the caviar.
You're ruining perfectly good hash browns.
Okay.
And a 5-pound empanada feels like that's one of those challenges you would take.
Yeah, it's not.
You don't want to eat it all. You take it home and you eat
you
it.
You take it home?
You'd be eating that for like 4 days. Yeah. It's 5 pounds of food.
I don't think I've ever taken anything out of the stadium.
If I got something to take it out of the stadium with, I take it home, man. I'm going to eat 5 pounds.
What's that grease in Lloyd's pocket? That's his empanada. Yeah. Leave it alone.
He's Napoleon Dynamite putting the tots in his pocket.
Leave the man alone. That's his empanada. He'll punch you.
All right, how about this? The Twinkie Cheeseburger in, of all places, Los Angeles. It's a cheeseburger topped with a bacon-wrapped jalapeno that's stuffed with brisket and cream cheese. Yes.
I don't know.
I don't think I'd do that.
Yes. 1,000 times yes.
God.
That sounds incredible.
Oh, my God.
You're very easy to please.
Isn't he, though?
Yeah.
Cheeseburger, bacon-wrapped jalapeno with brisket? Yeah. That's a no-brainer.
But the cream
cheese. It
seems like a lot, and the cream cheese doesn't.
Well, but I mean, there's cream cheese sometimes in stuffed jalapenos.
I don't like stuffed jalapenos.
Okay.
Terrible. How about short rib poutine in Vancouver? Fries loaded with gravy, pulled short rib, and cheese curds.
Oh, yeah. That's a done deal.
Yes. And maple bacon smoky in Vancouver as well. It's a smoked sausage topped with bacon, onion jam, and maple syrup.
Yep.
Yes.
I'll do that.
All day.
And I ain't a big onion person, but I would do that, though. I'd try that one.
Oh, no, that feels like an Abby thing to me.
No.
Fair enough.
It's a no for me. That's what she said.
It's pretty good. The beers, though, in these stadiums also are quite pricey. Like $20 beers. I'm down on all these. Yeah.
So it's a...
Clean
sweep for you?
No, that's not true. I don't think I'd eat the empanada. It's just a lot. It's too heavy.
I'm not a fan of the poutine.
Coming up next, Jamie joins the show. It's JR Morning.
Stick around for All Talk at 9 with Kevin Dietz. Then Focus with Paul W. Smith at noon on 760 WJR and on the WJR app. Now it's JR Morning. Here's Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds.
One of our favorite times of the show on a Friday, we get to talk with our pal Jamie Edmonds.
Yes,
Jamie, good morning.
Ma'am.
Good morning, guys. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
All right, we're almost to bell ringing time, aren't we?
We are almost to bell ringing time, but who's counting? I have two more treatments left, and I can't wait to ring that bell.
Well, you sound good. How you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good because I'm on the back end of the treatment, you know, so I got to get another one on Monday. So I always feel like myself, then it's time for another treatment, you know.
Yeah. And after you have that treatment, I mean, how do you feel? Does it take a little while for you to kind of get back to yourself again?
Just sort of wiped out. And I'm grateful that, you know, this drug that scared me a whole lot.
Yeah.
So far, it's just been fatigue that has been sort of the side effect that I'm facing with this one. And that is something that is manageable and I can do.
And that's the Red Devil is what they call it, the treatment.
Right.
So that's a heavier dose of the chemo.
Yes.
Treatment. And
the way they explained it yesterday, I was at the oncologist yesterday. This mm-hmm. is a powerful drug, more powerful than the other one.
Okay.
But the other one I felt worse on. So I don't know what's going on over here, but I'll take what I can get.
No doubt about it.
Yes.
And so like, what do people generally feel when they get on the heavier dose, the heavier drug?
Oh man, there's what I'm finding is everyone is different in terms of their biology and things, but there are some side effects that aren't pleasant. There's nausea, there's sort of just a lot of things, mouth sores, and a lot of things that I haven't experienced. Do you hear me knocking?
We hear it. It's
Thank
a
God.
Very loud knock.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the podcast, Jamie's Journey, tell us about the podcast that happened this week.
So I did a couple this week. One was about eyebrows, a whole pod about eyebrows, you guys. Mm. It's very important to me. One of the first calls I made was to this lady who does microblading and micro shading, which is just sort of like a, it's not a tattoo, but it's kind of like a tattoo.
Okay.
So your eyebrows are more full when you're a healthy person.
Uh-huh.
And for me, I was like, well, then that should help me a little bit when I'm losing all my hair to have a little template. So I have some eyebrows. So she was really great. And she came in on her off day to do it for me. So she's one of my angels. And we talked all about eyebrows. And she told me at the end to keep the faith. And I'm like, well, keep the faith and your eyebrows. So that's what I named that podcast.
Very
I never thought about then, losing your eyebrows.
No.
I mean, it makes sense. I just never thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, you guys, I knew I was going to lose my hair. And then when one of the nurses said eyebrows and eyelashes, that was a really hard moment for me. I cried to my mom about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh my gosh, so I'm going to lose my hair on my head and on my face. I'm going to look like an alien. And she said, you know, it's going to be okay. Everything's going to grow back. But I tried my hardest to try and keep some normalcy with the eyebrow lady.
Yeah.
And then the other podcast that dropped yesterday was with a medical oncologist from Sloan Kettering, who we had some fun. We laughed and she talked about her book. She wrote this book called Calming the Cancer Chaos.
Okay.
And it has like a workbook attached. And it is very informative. I wish I had it right when I was diagnosed because it tells you the terms that you're about to hear. And it tells you sort of how to keep track of all of your files and your scans. And it's just a really great conversation and it really prepares you for what's ahead.
And like I said all the time, that the podcast is helping so many people and people are listening to it, getting, you know, feeling better about themselves as they go through these types of issues. And then now talking to this person from Sloan Kettering and talking about, you know, this workbook and those things, those are some things I'm sure people didn't know about and that's going to help somebody as well.
I mean, I hope so. Like I said, the messages that I'm getting from people are just sort of so beautiful and make me think this is all worth it. I recently just got a message from a friend of mine, someone I know, texted me and said, thank you for keeping it so real. My mom is also affected by cancer and your content has been so valuable. So hopefully me putting all this stuff out there about, you know, eyebrows and talking about cancer issues with oncologists and experts is helping.
Well, it's good to hear you're feeling well at the moment. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of chemo treatments remaining, and then we're ringing a bell and
go to the next phase.
Yeah, but
do you guys want to tease an upcoming podcast? Maybe
I don't think that, I don't think that's for us to do.
The upcoming podcast coming up on next Thursday, July 2nd, is with people you know. One is named Chris, and one is named Lloyd.
We got an invite to the
pod. It was great. It was excellent. It was just good for us to be together again like we are this morning. It's just great. You know, we just hit the ground running. We love each other, and we just kind of do our thing, you know?
Yeah, and you know, again, it's like all these different facets of life. You've got your family. You've got your friends. And it's like, you know, the people that you work with are –
You see them a lot more, sometimes more than you see your family.
Right. So having that support
sometimes
system is
good.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, so that was
yeah,
that
and
was
I just thought,
cool.
let's all chat, let's all sit down and chat because I mean you have been going through it in some way with me because I left a show that we were on, so
right.
I thought let's talk about it and we're going to, and I think we had some fun, we had some laughs,
definitely.
And that comes out on July 2nd.
And by the way, true to her journalistic integrity, she did not provide any forward questions.
No, she did
we
not.
Got no advance.
Nope.
We got nothing.
That's not how
Jamie.
I work.
that's not
how I work.
Not how she gets down.
All right. I don't know if you heard. We did some of the foods that you can get at the World Cup. Just give me a yay or nay on these. Are you ready?
Okay.
The fancy AF tots in Miami. 3 fried hash browns topped with caviar and creme fraiche and chives. Yes or no?
100%.
Yes. The empanada mundial, also in Miami. 5-pound chicken and cheese empanada.
Too much food. No.
The Twinkie Cheeseburger in Los Angeles. Cheeseburger topped with a bacon-wrapped jalapeno stuffed with brisket and cream cheese.
No. Out.
Out. The Short Rib Poutine in Vancouver. Fries, gravy, pulled short rib, and cheese curds.
I'd try that. Once again, that seems like too much food to me, but I'd try that.
It is a little heavy. And the maple bacon smoky in Vancouver as well. Smoked sausage topped with bacon, onion jam, and maple syrup.
No, thank you. No. But have you guys seen these things of the Europeans in our country trying American things?
Oh,
it's hilarious.
It's the best.
And loving ranch.
I love it.
And smuggling ranch.
Did you hear about the ranch?
Ranch back.
Have you seen that?
I've heard about the ranch. I've heard about them. Going nuts for Dunkin' Donuts.
Dunkin' Donuts.
Yes, big deal.
Buc-ee's,
yep.
But they're trying to, they're like buying bottles of ranch at the grocery store and trying to bring them back on the plane.
And like,
the TSA's like, no,
no,
that's too much liquid. You can't bring six bottles of ranch back on your carry-on.
You got to pack that. You can't carry that
right.
on.
Right.
Yeah.
They're taking pictures at grocery stores in front of the, you know, the ranch
section. One of my favorite videos is of an English fan at Old Country Buffet. No, not Old Country Buffet.
Waffle
Cracker
House?
Barrel. Cracker Barrel.
Okay.
Eating biscuits and gravy. And he's like, what is this? This is the greatest thing that I've ever eaten in my life. It's so funny.
I also saw maybe someone from England being like, the portions in America are so huge.
Yeah. I saw this AI video and they were like, why can't we have free refills here like they do in the United States? I want another soda or whatever it is.
There's some overconsumption over here, and that.
Oh,
we
definitely.
Know.
Well, now they're getting stands out. It's like a great aside to the games and to all the excitement about what's going on the pitch.
Yeah.
But to actually have these people try the cuisine, go around, drink the drinks is a cool part to all this. You dialed in?
I'm dialed in. I'm a soccer fan now. I was watching Turkey A beat USA.
Turkey A. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. Turkey A. Jamie, have a nice weekend. We'll talk to you next week, hopefully. I'm so glad you're feeling well. It was nice to see you yesterday.
Yes.
And we'll talk next week.
Thanks, guys. Talk soon.
See ya. That's Jamie Edmonds. Coming up next, still more show to go. The Hanna Center, the oldest aging services center in the state of Michigan. We'll talk to the president and CEO. It's JR Morning. Well, taking care of the elderly family members in your life is a huge priority.
Absolutely.
As folks get older, they need more attention. They need more services. And that's where the Hanna Center comes in. And they are the oldest aging service center in the state of Michigan. And Vincent Tilford's the president and CEO and joins us this morning. Vincent, good morning. It's good to talk with you. We have Vincent. Vincent, are you there?
I am. How are you?
Very good. We're well. Talk a little bit about what you guys are doing at the Hanna Center and how you're taking care of some of our beloved family members.
Well, at Hanna, we try to meet our seniors wherever they may be. We believe that the people that we serve, they are the experts on their lives. And so with them sort of in the driver's seat, we try to help them with things they might need, from basic needs all the way up to socialization and, you know, realizing dreams and becoming artists and that kind of thing. And we offer this through a variety of programs. We have social work programs that provide adult day services for people that have a dementia diagnosis. And we also support the caregiver as well, equally. We have lifelong learning classes where people can come and kind of meet people from their tribe, people who are interested in the kinds of things they're interested in learning. So we have ceramics, painting, drawing, theater, just a variety of classes where people can kind of come and sort of develop their talents there. And then we also take resources out into the community. We have a team of people that go to senior apartment buildings. We try to bring occupational therapy services, art classes to them. Again, sort of whatever their need. But we're always trying to either meet anything from basic needs up to, you know, self-actualization, helping people to sort of connect and stay integrated in our community.
Vincent, do you find that many older adults come in kind of thinking they're there to receive help, but they end up contributing just as much back to the community?
Oh, man, absolutely. I could give you an example from my own personal life, you know, where, you know, my mom moved here to help my wife and I to raise our kids. She was 70 years old when she moved to Detroit to help us with that. I was talking to a lady yesterday who has a mom in our adult day program for people with dementia. And she liked the program and what we were doing so much, she stayed on and began volunteering in one of our programs that we call Friendly Caller. So we call older adults who might be isolated or may not have a lot of contact with people. And we call to check on them, see what they need. And she's telling me this story about how she's talking to this woman. It turned out she knew her from very many years ago. So this happens all the time. And that's the one thing we want people to realize is that older people contribute a lot to our community. We're not just takers, we are givers, and we've actually given things all of our lives. And so we always want to lift that up and support the seniors.
And, you know, we often celebrate youth and productivity and speed in our culture, but how do we shift that narrative to celebrate aging as a stage of growth and contribution?
Well, you know, one of the programs that we do here is called 70 Over 70. And this is where we recognize seniors in seven different categories. We recognize 10 seniors per category, things like art, civic engagement, unsung hero, entrepreneurship, lifelong learning. And we want to showcase that just because you've reached a certain age, your talent, your skills, your potential, things that you're able to contribute, they don't have an expiration date, you know, until we're in the ground, right?
Right.
But until that point, you know, people have a lot to contribute. I remember a guy that was in a wheelchair. He was in his early 90s, and he was one of our top winners in our 70 over 70. And he could hardly feed himself. But what this man was able to do was he researched a case of a guy that had been wrongly convicted of murder and got him exonerated.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, seniors bring a whole lot of talents to the table.
And, you know, do you need volunteers? What can people do if they want to help Hannon Center?
Many, many ways. So number one, we're always looking people for our Friendly Caller program. We'll bring you in. We'll train you for that. We have, as I mentioned, our 70 over 70 program where we ask people to nominate seniors in these categories that I mentioned earlier. That event's going to take place on October 3rd. And so we're encouraging people that if there's someone over the age of 70 that you know is doing fantastic, great things in a community, they're helping out your family, they're helping out, you know, the city, whatever it might be, if you think they're worthy, write them up. And you can get that on our website at hannon.org. And there's a 70 over 70 tab there that they can click on and put in a nomination there. And then we're always, always looking for donations, right? This is a difficult time. You kind of alluded to it earlier about, you know, how people sort of look at seniors, and nobody wants to get older. And so when you see an older person, it's a reminder that, you know, it's not something that you want to be. And so we don't get the kind of support that, say, puppies and children get, because they're cute and cuddly, right?
Yeah.
But we all have things that we bring to the world, and seniors need that support as well.
Awesome stuff that you guys are doing at the Hannon Center. Vincent Tilford, thank you for your time this morning. We appreciate it. Keep up the good work, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. All right, this is not so great news.
Okay.
On a good news Friday.
Okay, what do you got?
This is from Yahoo Sports 23 minutes ago.
Okay.
Detroit's all-NBA forward Jalen Duren was reportedly, quote, underwhelmed by the team's initial offer in restricted free agency and is planning to explore sign-and-trade scenarios.
Oh.
The gap between the two sides is significant enough that Duren is considering ways to land with another team with a sign-and-trade scene as the preferred route.
That's not good news. We want to not get that.
Not that it's a done deal, that he wants out, things like that, but... But that initial initial contract offer was not where he thought
not
it would
where
be.
He thought it should be. Okay,
it is a bit of a bummer.
It is,
but again, nothing's finalized. There's no news on that front.
Yeah,
but that's just in the last couple of minutes, so something to keep an eye on as we get into the weekend.
Well, hopefully, they're still working.
That's exactly right. All right, have yourself a wonderful weekend. All Talk coming your way next.